The labor pains of Regia shook the small stone house, her cries echoing out toward the Nile. Inside, her belly stirred the future of Egypt. Triplets, destined by the sun god Ra to wrench the crown from the current dynasty. Sensing the momentous hour, Ra dispatched a divine delegation disguised as mortal traveling musicians. Among them walked Isis, her piercing intellect hidden behind a humble linen shawl. She was flanked by Nephthys, Maskenet, Heket, and the porter Khnum. The worried husband welcomed the musicians inside the home, desperate for any comfort for his groaning wife. Closing the door of the birth chamber, the goddesses shed their mortal guises, their skin radiating a faint gold leaf warmth. Isis stepped forward, taking her place directly in front of Regjet as the labor reached its peak. "Do not grow weak, Regjet," Isis whispered, her voice carrying the rhythmic resonance of a cosmic lullaby. "Let the child break through." As the first infant slid into Isis's waiting hands, a sudden supernatural radiance filled the room. The baby was a cubit long, bone sturdy as bronze, wearing a royal kilt of the fine linen and a headdress of real lapis lazuli. Isis washed the child, cutting his cord and laying him upon a soft bed of cloth. "A child who steps forcefully," she decreed, giving him the names that would echo throughout history. Userkaf, the first king of the fifth dynasty. Without a moment's pause, the sacred rhythm began again. Isis leaned in close as the second and then the third divine boy entered the world. Their names were Sahure and Neferirkare, each born with the literal splendor of kingship woven into their skin. As Maskenet breathed destiny over their fragile brows, and Khnum blessed their limbs with physical strength, Isis stood over the three newborn sons, and she smiled, holding the secret knowledge of empires yet to rise, before quietly wrapping them in linen and dissolving back into the desert wind with her sister gods. In the modern world, going to the doctor often means taking a passive stance. You lie back, you take a pill, and then you let the medicine do the work. But in the clinics of ancient Egypt, healing was a full contact participatory sport. The Egyptians understood a profound psychological truth. To fight an illness, a patient needs to feel a sense of agency, actively reclaiming control over their own body, to experience useful psychological benefits. To achieve this, Egyptian healers developed a brilliant psychological technique known as divine identification. If a patient was burning with a fever or writhing from a scorpion sting, the healer wouldn't just treat the physical symptom. They would look the patient in the eye and radically redefine their identity. The patient was instructed to stop being a helpless, fragile mortal and to physically transform their mind into the form of a god who had already faced this exact agony and triumph. The magician would chant over the suffering individual. Here's an example from the Metternich Stela. "You are Horus. No poison has power over your limbs." Because the young god Horus had been bitten, stung, and successfully cured by his mother Isis time and time again, he was the ultimate archetype of survival. Isis and Horus are the deities that are most frequently referred to in this way. Horus, mainly because he had been healed so many times and can rely on his mother to assist him. And then there's Isis because she possesses the great Heka and knowledge, allowing her to call on powerful allies such as Thoth. By mentally stepping into Horus's shoes, the patient absorbed his cosmic resilience, absorbed his confidence that the Great Mother was standing over them and she was ready to secure a cure. When the pain inside the body became too intense to bear, Egyptian medicine utilized a captivating concept called transference, literally pulling the sickness out of the human flesh and trapping it inside of a physical object. In one fascinating domestic ritual, a patient suffering from a severe stomach ailment wouldn't just endure the cramps. They would actively project the agony directly into a clay figurine. Remarkably, one surviving spell instructs the healer to transfer the stomachache directly into a clay statue of Isis herself, declaring the following: anything he suffers from in his belly, the affliction will be sent down from him into the Isis statue until he is healed. So for us, using an image of a revered goddess as a spiritual, we can say maybe trash can for human illness, feels almost sacrilegious. It's often argued that it would make more sense to transfer the pain into an anonymous statue, which could then be destroyed, rather than into the image of goddess Isis. Why should we risk offending her? Perhaps it was believed that only a vessel that's infused with the raw concentrated Heka of Isis possessed a spiritual engine that was potent enough to deal with whatever was causing the pain. While other rituals utilized anonymous clay figurines, the use of Isis's image represents the ultimate act of desperate, faithful magic. Because the spoken and written word carried a literal physical potency in ancient Egypt, language itself became an active ingredient in prescriptions. If a spell possessed the power to cause a quote-unquote complete destruction of the person, the text gives the healer a choice in how to administer it. From here we learn there are two paths of kinetic magic. First, there is the ingestion. The healer could write the sacred hieroglyphs directly onto a fresh sheet of papyrus, intentionally wash the ink off into a liquid, and force the patient to drink it. By swallowing the dissolved ink, the patient physically ingested the magical formula, letting the words fight the venom from the inside out. The second path is what's called the binding. So alternatively, the spell could be inscribed onto a band of linen and tied securely around the patient's throat like a magical tourniquet. To activate either method, the healer would recite the incantations over images of Isis, Atum, and Horus, turning a simple physical treatment into a kinetic cosmic event. For those who were suffering from chronic elusive illnesses that standard remedies just couldn't touch, the ultimate recourse was incubation, the sacred practice of sleeping overnight within a temple or a sacred area in anticipation of healing or receiving advice through dreams and visions. Patients would travel for miles to the grand temples of Isis and her consort Serapis, laying their heads down on the stone floors in anticipation of a divine visitation. They believed that as they drifted off to sleep, the goddess herself would slip directly into their dreams to perform a miraculous cure. As the ancient historian Diodorus Siculus elegantly recorded, "Hovering near the sick while they slumber, she grants them succor in their afflictions." This practice was so wildly popular that the fees collected from these hopeful sleeping pilgrims formed a significant part of the temple's income. During the Greco-Roman period, the Temple of Isis at Maynuthis near Alexandria became famous for these miraculous magical cures. The profound desperate hopes of these ancient patients is captured beautifully in a surviving letter from this era where a traveler simply writes home. "I was in the great temple of Isis for healing, owing to the sickness from which I was suffering." By the dawn of the Greco-Roman period, the cosmological role of Isis expanded so profoundly that she transitioned from a traditional funerary protectress into the supreme patron goddess of pharmacists and alchemists. No longer just a weaver of spells, she was now credited with mastering the physical elements of pharmacology, having reportedly discovered the world's first healing drugs and the ultimate elixir of life. As the ancient historian Diodorus Siculus recorded, the Egyptians credit Isis with the discovery of many therapeutic drugs, as well as the coveted elixir of immortality. Her pharmaceutical resume was quite legendary, even catching the attention of the famous physical Galen, who noted that Isis had successfully engineered specific drugs that were capable of staunching severe bleeding, curing chronic headaches, and rapidly healing deep wounds and bone fractures. Because Isis was viewed as the true architect of medicine, the very act of gathering healing plants became a highly ritualized religious performance. When ancient herbalists and sorcerers forged into nature to harvest the necessary ingredients, they would recite a mandatory invocation directly to the plant, declaring the following: "You were given birth by Isis." The dense magical handbook of the era, which is the Greek magical papyri, frequently mentions a mysterious botanical defense simply known as the amulet plant of Isis. Similarly, other historical texts track an enigmatic specimen called the footprint of Isis plant. Though modern botanists have never been able to identify either species, other sacred flora are well documented. First, we have the Persea tree. The leaves and fruit of this tree were revered as a universal cure-all, and the entire species was held strictly sacred to Isis. Next, we have black horehound. This specific bitter herb was known to ancient practitioners by the visceral title, the blood of Isis. In the ancient clinic, compounding a medicine was an act of cosmic creation. A physical recipe was considered entirely inert unless it was awakened by a matching historiola or a mythical chant. So for instance, if a patient arrived with a dangerous dog bite, the laden papyrus dictates that the primary physical ingredient to prepare was crushed garlic. But as the physician actively mashed the cloves, they were required to chant words that were directly channeled from the goddess's supreme unassailable power. And here we have one example. I will do for thee, like the voice of Isis, the sorceress who bewitches everything and is not bewitched in her name of Isis the sorceress. By speaking these words over the mortar and pestle, the common garlic was spiritually transformed into a weapon wielded by the ultimate sorceress, imbuing the physical poultice with the power to conquer the infection. When herbs and garlic weren't enough, Egyptian doctors turned to the very earth beneath their feet. Nile clay was cheap, it was abundant, and it was widely used to manufacture healing artifacts and topical ointments. But to the Egyptians, clay was never just mud. It was a highly charged magical substance intimately connected to the origins of life. According to state theology, the great potter god Khnum had originally molded human bodies out of clay on his cosmic wheel before breathing life directly into them. Because both the land of Egypt and human flesh shared this identical chemical and spiritual origin, clay possessed an innate sympathetic power to knit human bodies back together. It was a substance capable of both supreme creation and deadly intent. After all, it was this very same primordial Nile clay that Isis had once mixed with Ra's divine saliva to mold the cosmic cobra that brought the sun god to his knees. In the sun-baked landscape of ancient Egypt, snake bites and scorpion stings were terrifying. They were everyday hazards, and they sparked the creation of a vast library of protective spells and emergency remedies. While patients cried out to many different gods in their panic, it was Isis who was summoned the most frequently, just due to her legendary firsthand experience with venom. Rarely working alone in these moments of crisis, Isis often collaborated with her sister Nephthys. On the famous Metternich stela, a vivid medical ritual is recorded where Isis spins the threads and Nephthys weaves a sacred fabric to be used as a medical tourniquet against advancing venom. Far from a simple piece of cloth, the sisters were actively weaving a kinetic web of Heka, a spiritual net designed to trap, contain, and physically draw the chaotic forces of evil out of the patient's body. While most adult Egyptians survived the agonizing but short-term effects of a typical scorpion sting, the venom was notoriously fatal to small children whose lower body weight meant that they received a concentrated, deadly dose. This terrifying reality was mirrored perfectly in the heavens. Even the god Horus, while he was playing as a vulnerable child and hidden in the Delta marshes, he was critically stung. The text remind suffering children that they shared the destiny of the young god, urging the following: may your mother Isis recite spells over you. All her words are effective. Another intriguing spell from the Greek magical papyri captures the raw human intimacy of this divine relationship, with the patient reciting the following: I sat down and I wept. Isis, my mother, sat near me saying, do not weep. These deeply comforting words meant everything to an ancient patient who was not only writhing in physical agony, but genuinely fearing for their life. By promising that nothing bad will happen to you, you will not die from the heat of the poison will have no power over your body, the loving and fiercely powerful presence of Isis acted as a psychological antidote, breaking the circuit of panic and bringing profound relief to a distressed patient. To understand why Isis held such absolute authority over venom, Egyptian physicians looked to the supreme cosmic precedent recorded in the Turin Papyrus. The text preserves the exact high-stakes formula that Isis chanted to purge the sun god Ra of his burning affliction. And it reads the following: "Leave Ra, flame of the mouth. I am the one who made you. I am the one who sent you. Come to the earth, powerful poison. Ra shall live once the poison has died." Because Isis had secretly manufactured the original clay serpent that bit Ra, she possessed ultimate sovereignty over the affliction. In the mechanics of Egyptian magic, knowing the true origin, identity, and secret name of a threat gave a sorcerer absolute command over it. Consequently, almost every real-world medical spell used by Egyptian magician physicians to draw out venom, it was structurally anchored in this specific myth, transforming every ordinary poison citizen into Ra or the child Horus, destined to be saved by the master of magic. In ancient Egypt, crossing the threshold of childbirth was akin to entering a battlefield. It was a notoriously hazardous journey. Countless women succumbed to the perils of labor, many more endured lifelong physical complications, and infant mortality rates were staggeringly high during the first year of life. To navigate this terrifying transition, expectant mothers relied on a highly specialized divine medical board. While goddesses like Hathor, the fierce hippopotamus deity Tawaret, and Meskhenet, who was the personification of the birthing bricks, were the primary guardians of the delivery room, Isis held a uniquely profound psychological position. According to later Greek erotologies, it was Isis herself who originally decreed the precise 9-month duration of human pregnancy. Though she was not the traditional goddess of labor, mortal women in the throes of agonizing contractions identified with her deeply because she too had known the raw, isolating pain of bringing a child into the world. When a labor became dangerously prolonged, ancient Egyptian midwives and the magician physicians didn't just stand by. They deployed a brilliant tactical script preserved in the Leyden Papyrus that's simply titled, "For Speeding Up the Childbirth of Isis." In the mechanics of Egyptian healing, both the patient and the healer had to structurally align themselves with the characters from cosmic myth. The midwife would loudly proclaim to the heavens that it was not a mortal woman suffering on the birthing stool, but Isis herself who was trapped in perilous labor. And this cosmic deception served two vital purposes. First, the goal was to convince the pantheon that Isis is the one at risk, forcing them to rush to the scene with aid. The second goal was to frighten and fool the malicious spirits that were causing the delay, causing them to flee the room in panic. If this supernatural trickery failed to move the cosmos, the spell took a dark, dramatic turn, launching into a cosmic blackmail sequence. The practitioner would rattle off the terrifying list of universal catastrophes that would occur if Isis was not allowed to safely give birth, threatening that the stars would fall and the Nile would dry up until the gods capitulated and granted a safe delivery. The image of Isis as an active hands-on midwife is brought to life in the famous late period Westcar Papyrus. The text recounts the mythical difficult birth of royal triplets born to Queen Rudadet. Recognizing the queen's mortal danger, the sun god Ra summons a divine elite task force consisting of Isis, Nephthys, Meskhenet, and the frog goddess Hecate. Disguising themselves as traveling mortal midwives, the goddesses infiltrate the palace to assist. During the delivery, a beautiful ritual choreography takes place. Isis positions herself protectively directly in front of the queen, while Nephthys supports her from behind. As Hecate uses her ancient powers to hasten the physical delivery, Isis catches each newborn king, greets them, officially bestows their names, and triumphantly announces their grand earthly destinies. While ancient devotees regularly prayed to Isis to preserve a pregnancy, she was rarely petitioned for human fertility in the same way as primal fertility goddesses like Hathor or the cat goddess Bastet. The distinction makes perfect cosmological sense when looking at her mythic history. Isis didn't conceive naturally. She famously had to utilize high necromagical rituals to temporarily reanimate the corpse of her murdered husband, Osiris, then becoming pregnant only through an extraordinary act of Hecate. Because this miraculous supernatural conception was not a reality ordinary mortal women wished to emulate, her role remained strictly focused on the preservation and healing of life rather than the spark of conception itself. As her popularity grew, her capacity for miraculous clinical intervention became the centerpiece of her faith. Her worldwide devotees were intensely eager to share stories of her medical skill and boundless empathy. The historian Diodorus Siculus captured this absolute awe surrounding her universal clinic, writing that her reputation was built on spectacular real-world results. He states the following. He says she even saves many of those for whom the doctors have despaired. Close your eyes and imagine a darkness so absolute that it feels heavy against your skin. You are standing on the threshold of the Duat, the ancient Egyptian underworld. In your cold hands, you grip a papyrus scroll written in ink and shadow, your only weapon against rivers of fire and gods who dance in blood. The ancients called this sacred blueprint the Chapters of Coming Forth by Day. A map of cosmic survival designed to guide your fragile soul to its final terrifying judgment. But as you prepare to step into the abyss, a sudden rush of cool air catches your cheek. Out of the midnight twilight steps a magnificent winged sovereign. She is the mistress of Hecate, the weaver of resurrection, and the only force capable of breathing life back into your pale lips. When a member of the Egyptian elite died, the silence of their grand villa was instantly shattered. The family didn't mourn in quiet isolation. Death was a loud communal event. Relatives would plaster their faces and hair with mud from the Nile, rushing through the streets of the city, weeping and wailing to announce the passing. For the wealthy, professional mourners who were women known as the kites of Isis, they were hired to wail, beat their breasts, and tear their clothes. Their sharp, rhythmic cries mimicked the primal lamentations of Isis when she wept over the broken body of Osiris, sonically charging the atmosphere with sacred grief. The corpse was immediately removed from the home and transported across the Nile to the West Bank, the land of the setting sun, where it was delivered to the Ibu, or the place of purification. This was an open-air tent where the body was washed with clean water from the Nile, and it was purified with a natural salt crust to prepare it for the sacred alchemy of mummification. Mummification wasn't merely this chemical preservation. It was a profound 70-day religious ritual where every cut of the knife was accompanied by a whispered spell. So first, the embalmers used a long iron hook to carefully extract the brain through the nostrils. To the ancient Egyptians, the brain was useless water, so it was discarded. The heart, however, was treated with absolute reverence. It was left untouched inside the chest cavity because it was believed to be the center of intelligence, memory, and the soul itself, and it would be needed on the scales of judgment. Then, a sacred incision was made on the left side of the abdomen using a blade of black obsidian, or flint. Through this slit, the embalmers removed the internal organs. Because these soft tissues would cause the body to decay, they had to be preserved separately. The extracted organs were washed. They were dehydrated in natron salt. They were wrapped in fine linen and placed into four distinct containers known as canopic jars. Each jar was protected by one of the four sons of Horus, specific minor deities assigned to guard the deceased's anatomy. With the organs safely housed, the empty torso was stuffed with temporary packets of natron, straw, and fragrant spices like myrrh and cassia to help it hold its shape. The body was then buried under a mountain of natron salt for 40 days until every drop of moisture was entirely wicked away, leaving the flesh darkened, hardened, and completely sterile. Once dried, the temporary stuffing was removed and replaced with clean linen. It was replaced also with sawdust and aromatic resins. The skin was massaged with sacred oils, milk, and perfumes to make it supple again, and the abdominal incision was sewn shut and covered with a golden amulet for protection. Then began the hypnotic days-long process of wrapping. The embalmers wound hundreds of yards of fine linen strips around the limbs, the fingers, and the torso. As they wrapped, priests tucked protective amulets like the Ankh for vitality and the Eye of Horus for healing deep within the linen layers. A sticky dark resin was poured over the bandages, acting as a cosmic glue that sealed the body into an unyielding protective cocoon. On the day of the funeral, a grand procession wound its way toward the cliffside tombs of the elite. The mummy, now housed in a beautifully painted, lifelike wooden coffin, was pulled on a sled toward its final resting place. Behind it walked the family, the weeping mourners, and priests carrying the deceased earthly treasures, which were golden jewelry, fine clothing, furniture, cosmetic boxes, and those crucial canopic jars. Before the coffin was lowered into the dark stone vault, the priests performed the most critical ritual at the tomb's entrance. This was called the opening of the mouth. Using a sacred copper adze, which was a chisel-like tool, a priest touched the eyes, the nose, the ears, and the mouth of the wooden coffin face. This was a beautiful act of spiritual awakening, magically restored the deceased's senses, allowing the soul to breathe, speak, see, and eat in the afterlife. Without this ritual, the mummy was just a dead shell, but with it, the body became an active temple for the spirit. To celebrate this successful awakening, the living held a grand banquet right outside the tomb door. This was not some somber meal. It was a joyous, sensory-rich feast filled with music, wine, and laughter. The living ate roasted ox, they ate figs, pomegranates, and honey bread alongside their dead relative. Huge piles of food and jars of beer were then carried into the tomb's offering chapel. This was called the Mentu, or the Eternal Provisions. The Egyptians believed that while the physical body remained in the tomb, the soul, or the ka, would emerge from the coffin to spiritually consume the essence of these meals. And then, finally, the tomb was sealed. The heavy stone doors were locked, the footprints in the sand were swept away, and the living returned across to the Nile, to the land of the living, leaving the elite soul standing completely alone in the pitch-black silence of the tomb, ready to begin their harrowing descent into the underworld. When a mortal dies, their spirit wakes at the gates of a twilight world. It's filled with jagged caverns, rivers of fire, and monstrous guardians with names like He Who Dances in Blood. To navigate this labyrinth, the deceased must recite exact hidden spells from the papyrus to outwit these gatekeepers. The entire journey builds towards a final, hauntingly quiet moment, the weighing of the heart. In the Great Hall of Maat, the soul's heart is placed on a golden scale, balanced against the feather of cosmic truth. If the heart is heavy, it's instantly devoured by Ahmet, a monstrous beast who erases the soul from existence forever. But if the scale stays perfectly balanced, the soul is granted eternity, transforming into a brilliant, shimmering star. So while Anubis balances the scales and Osiris judges the dead, Isis holds the fragile thread of the soul's ultimate survival. Her role within these funerary papyri is profound, it's ancient, and it's deeply intimate. She is the ultimate protector. She's the cosmic architect of resurrection who once knit her own murdered husband back together. And she brings that exact same fierce maternal magic to every mortal soul who's traversing the dark. So in the Book of the Dead, Isis has specific heavy responsibilities. First, she's the weaver of Heka, or sacred magic. It's Isis who speaks the primary incantations that the deceased must memorize. Her voice gives the dead their power. Without her whispered words of power woven into the papyrus, the soul remains mute and defenseless against the underworld's demons. She's also the restorer of breath. In the quiet moments after the physical body is mummified, Isis is responsible for the spiritual resurrection. She stands at the head of the bier, beating her wings to generate the divine breath of life, forcefully waking the soul from its mortal slumber. She's also the advocate at the scales. During the terrifying ordeal of the weighing of the heart, Isis stands directly behind the deceased. She acts as their divine defense attorney, wrapping her arms around them, channeling her immense power to shield them from fear and ensuring that the scales tilt toward mercy and eternal life. In the Book of Going Forth by Day, or the Egyptian Book of the Dead as we traditionally call it, Isis is depicted as the shadowed mourner. She's frequently painted standing at the feet or the head of the sarcophagus, draped in a sheer dark linen. Her hands are upturned in a universal gesture of ancient lamentation. Her face is serene. However, it's heavy with grief, maybe the grief of a thousand lifetimes, embodying the sacred truth that out of deep mourning comes the power of rebirth. She's also depicted as the winged guardian. In these depictions, she's shown with the magnificent multicolored kite wings outstretched from her arms. These wings are lined with feathers of deep indigo, gold, and turquoise. She wraps these immense wings completely around the deceased in a protective stylized embrace, a visual boundary of absolute sanctuary, cutting through this pitch black void of the underworld. She also is depicted as the throne and the key. Atop her head rests her signature hieroglyph, which is the throne, signifying that she is the seat of cosmic sovereignty itself. In her hands, she tightly grips the Ankh, the key of eternal life, offering its golden light to the pale lips of the soul, welcoming them out of the darkness and into the everlasting day. Ultimately, Isis represents the promise that no soul is truly abandoned to the dark. She's the divine attorney at the scales. She's the weaver of resurrecting breath and the eternal mother to the spirits emerging from the tomb. In the world of the Duat, or the underworld, Anubis may weigh the heart and Osiris may judge the past, but it's Isis who ensures the future. She is the dawn breaking through the ultimate shadow, holding the golden key of life to the lips of the pale dead. In spell 151, Isis speaks directly to the deceased to establish an unbreakable boundary of safety around them. It reads the following: I have come to be your protector. I waft the sweet breath of the north wind into your nostrils and the air which comes from the breath of the living God. I have knit together your throat. I have placed your enemies under your feet, and I have made you victorious before the gods. Because Isis famously gathered and rebuilt the broken body of her husband Osiris, she promises the same physical restoration to the deceased. In various passages throughout the text, she commands the elements of the corpse to reassemble, and it reads the following: I am Isis, and I have come to wrap you in fine linen, to give you back your flesh and to heal your wounds. Your head shall never be taken from you. Your limbs shall be joined together, and you shall wake alive upon the earth once more." During that terrifying trial of the weighing of the heart, Isis stands before the court of 42 divine judges and proclaims the soul's innocence, effectively demanding their entry into paradise, and it reads the following: "Behold, this soul is pure. The heart of this justified one has been weighed in the balance, and it is found without fault. No sin was found in them. Let them pass into the field of reeds among the stars that never set." In the underworld, a mute soul is a dead soul. Isis speaks to magically restore the deceased's vocal cords so that they can defend themselves against demons. And it reads the following in the book: "I have opened your mouth. I have given you your voice so that you may speak your words of power. By my magic, you shall command the rivers of fire, and the gatekeepers shall weep when they hear your name." Isis remains the ultimate keeper of the soul's deepest secrets. She's a goddess who intimately knows the agony of grief, having gathered the broken pieces of her beloved from the dust. And it's that exact unyielding protective fury that she extends to every soul that's traversing the void. Without her whispered magic woven into the papyrus, the spirit is entirely defenseless, left to be forgotten by time and devoured by the abyss. But wrapped in her indigo and gold feathers, a mortal becomes an immortal. In the silent space of the tomb, as the echoes of the funeral feast begin to fade away, it is the fierce, dark grace of Isis that stands between the soul and total erasure. The dead didn't just pray to Isis, they wore her power into the grave, beyond her role as the shadowed mourner, as the winged guardian, and the living throne. Her presence was physical. It was manifested in a hidden talisman called the Tayyat. Dating back to the early dynastic period of Egypt, the Tayyat, frequently called the Knot of Isis, the Goddess Knot, or the Buckle of Isis, stands as one of the most enduring symbols of absolute protection, primal magic, and cosmic welfare. While it looks strikingly similar to the Ankh or the hieroglyph for life, the Tayyat carries a distinct, deeply visceral current of energy that's uniquely tied to the sovereign power of Isis to bind, to release, to protect, and to receive. To understand the Tayyat, one must understand how the ancient Egyptians viewed knots. In the practice of Heka, a knot was a dynamic tool capable of binding and releasing cosmic energy. A knot joins opposite forces together, it seals intent, and creates an impenetrable barrier around whatever it secures. The physical structure of the Tayyat reflects this exact binding medicine. It's traditionally depicted as a long piece of sacred cloth, meticulously folded and cinched tightly in the center, featuring a fluid loop at the top and two soft arms hanging down at its sides. This looping-bound cloth was highly revered throughout Egyptian history, as evidenced by a powerful inscription from the ancient pyramid text, and it reads the following: "Isis and Nephthys work magic on thee, O Osiris, with knotted cords." Additionally, knot magic served as a spiritual passport for the soul. In the Book of the Dead, knots are explicitly tied to help the deceased safely cross the thresholds of the cosmos and enter the presence of the primordial creators, and it reads the following: "The four knots are tied about me by the guardian of the sky. The knot was tied about me by Nu when I first saw Maat. When the gods and sacred images had not yet been born, I am heaven-born. I am in the presence of the great gods." The Tayyat hieroglyph is most frequently translated directly as life or even welfare. When invoked in ritual work, it anchors four distinct streams of divine influence. Number one is absolute protection. It functions as an active shield against both physical harm in life and spiritual predators in death. Second is Isis's sovereign power. It represents the goddess's specific ability to shelter the vulnerable, receive the weary, and outwit cosmic enemies with her words of power. Next is regeneration and resurrection. It holds the blueprint of renewal, ensuring that what has been broken can be safely bound back together. Next is sacred sexuality and even fertility. Beyond its standard protective traits, many scholars view the Tayet symbol as an explicit fertility symbol. Its looping, its scent structure, represents the vulva and the womb of the goddess, symbolizing the fluid life-giving matrix from which all creation emerges. While small Tayet charms were worn by the living as everyday talismans of physical well-being, massive consecrated versions of the symbol played a vital role within the perilous geography of the underworld. So according to chapter 156 of the Book of the Dead, a highly specific ritual had to be executed during the mummification process. A Tayet amulet, carved strictly out of red jasper, carnelian, or even rich red glass, it had to be placed directly onto the neck of the deceased. The red material was non-negotiable. It visually and even vibrationally anchored the protective menstrual birthing and magical blood of the goddess Isis. During its placement, the embalming priest would chant the following command to ignite the amulet's magic. You have your blood, O Isis. You have your power, O Isis. You have your magic, O Isis. The amulet is a protection for this great one, which will repel anyone who would perform any hostile act against him. By painting the deceased in the literal blood and magic of Isis, the amulet formed an energetic armor, ensuring the soul's absolute safety as it navigated the trials of the Duat. In temple reliefs, sacred jewelry, and sarcophagus designs, the Tayet rarely stands alone. It's almost always paired as a complementary opposite to the Djed pillar, the ancient symbol representing the backbone, stability, and enduring resurrection of Osiris. Together, the Tayet and the Djed form the ultimate emblem of cosmic polarity and balance. When these two artifacts are brought together on an altar or even woven into a spell, they represent the harmonious blending of masculine and feminine currents. They symbolize the eternal endurance of the divine couple, proving that life, death, rebirth, and cosmic order are sustained only through the perfect, balanced integration of both forces. In the theater of Egyptian myth, Isis was the ultimate cosmic actress as well as the master shapeshifter. She rarely relied on brute force to conquer her enemies. Instead, she weaponized her Heka to fluidly warp her physical form, shifting identities to infiltrate, deceive, and manipulate the cosmic order. Her shapeshifting was never some mere parlor trick. It was a sophisticated deployment of divine camouflage used to outsmart her chaotic rival, Set. We see this masterfully executed within the narrative of the contendings of Horus and Set, which is preserved in the papyrus Chester Beatty. Barred from the divine courtroom on Set's strict orders, Isis refused to be sidelined. The text records that she performed a conjuration with her Heka, and she turned herself into a girl beautiful in all her body. This transfiguration allowed her to easily bypass security, slip into the tribunal of the gods, and utterly disarm Set. In that same legal battle, she pulled off an equally brilliant reverse transformation, masquerading as an impoverished old woman to trick Set into righteously denouncing a fictional crime, effectively forcing him to legally condemn his own actions. But her transformations could also take a far more violent, esoteric turn. In an alternative, darker version of the contendings, following a fierce confrontation where her own son Horus attacks her, Isis transforms herself into a headless flint statue. Now, to the ancient mind, choosing the form of flint was a deeply symbolic solar statement. Flint was considered celestial in origin, intimately tied to the sky goddess Hathor. Because striking two pieces of flint together produces a brilliant spark of fire, the Egyptians viewed the stone as a physical container of raw solar energy. by hard shifting into a flint statue. Isis was chemically merging her identity with Hathor and absorbing her solar power. The connection between flint and animation runs deep. In the Book of the Dead, a specific type of flint is revered as the giver of breath. This directly references the sacred flint adz used by priests during the opening of the mouth funeral ritual. As the ultimate restorer of life, Isis literally becomes the flint that cuts through the paralysis of death to give breath back to the deceased. When she wasn't walking amongst the mortals, Isis was adopting the forms of the animal kingdom to achieve her goals. When hunting for scattered pieces of her murdered husband, she famously transformed herself into a kite, which is a small bird of prey, hovering over the marshes of the Delta, using her beating wings to fan life back into Osiris's cold chest and shield his body from view. Her hidden manifestations were highly classified priestly secrets. A rare Ptolemaic manuscript recovered from an ancient temple library contains a specific restricted spell designed for, quote, knowing the secret form which Isis assumed for concealing the god in his hiding place. According to this tradition, while hiding Osiris's corpse in a sacred tamarisk grove near Busiris, Isis assumed the form of the sacred cow, again stepping into the maternal protective archetype of Hathor. This time, however, Set was not so easily fooled. We are told that the unique striking color of her hide immediately gave her identity away, though the scribes tantalizingly kept the exact color a secret. In another thrilling Greco-Roman epic, Isis takes the ultimate aggressive stance, launching a military campaign against Set by completely absorbing Hathor's most destructive alter ego, Sekhmet, the terrifying lioness goddess. This was a direct echo of the foundational myth of the destruction of mankind, where the sun god Ra originally sent Hathor to punish rebellious humans, causing her to mutate into the bloodthirsty Sekhmet. Hiding out on a rocky hillside, Isis, as Sekhmet, ambushed Set, unleashing a catastrophic blast of pure fire directly at him. Set immediately recognized her through the flames, likely because the real Sekhmet had never broken cosmic protocol to attack him before. To finish the job, Isis fluidly shifted forms once more, mutating into a venomous snake to bite and paralyze her adversary. During the Greco-Roman period, a profound religious exchange occurred across the Mediterranean, bringing classical deities to Egypt and sending ancient Egyptian gods across the sea. As Greek and Roman travelers immersed themselves in Egyptian religion, they filtered it through their own cultural lens, merging and assimilating distinct spiritual traditions. It was during this era of cross-cultural synthesis that Isis underwent the dramatic transformations that define how she's recognized today. Classical worshippers attributed entirely new domains of influence and symbolism to her, causing her list of titles to swell until she is hailed as Isis Merionimos, or Isis of the Innumerable Names. At the height of her empire-wide veneration, there was little left outside of her divine sphere of authority. One of the most radical shifts that Isis underwent through Greco-Roman eyes was her transition from a solar deity to a lunar goddess. Originally, Isis possessed strong solar connotations. She wore the uraeus at her brow, the rearing cobra representing the sun goddess, which explicitly identified her as the fierce Eye of Ra. Her solar attributes were further emphasized by her close mythological similarities with the great solar goddess Hathor. However, as her popularity expanded across the Mediterranean, she was radically reinterpreted. To the Greeks and the Romans, the sun was inherently masculine and the moon was feminine, a cosmic binary established early on in Hesiod's Theogony. Projecting this gendered concept of the divine feminine onto Isis, classical worshippers attached all lunar associations directly to her. Numerous reliefs and sculptures from this era depict Isis crowned by a distinct lunar crescent. This visual shift is vividly confirmed in Apuleius' Metamorphoses, where she emerges from the sea, and it reads as follows. I had hardly closed my eyes, where suddenly, from the midst of the sea, a divine face emerged, Above her forehead, a flat round disc like a mirror, or rather a symbol for the moon, just stirred with white light. Consequently, her traditional Egyptian iconography was completely reread. The horned headdress, originally understood by Egyptians to represent the celestial cow goddess who lifted the sun god between her horns to carry him to heaven, was reimagined as the tips of the moon, and it reads as follows by the historian Diodorus Siculus during the 1st century BC. They put horns on her head, both because of the appearance which she has to the eye when the moon is crescent-shaped, and because amongst the Egyptians a cow is regarded as sacred to her. While navigation on the open ocean was not a primary cultural focus for the ancient Egyptians, it was the absolute lifeblood of the Greeks and the Romans. This seafaring lifestyle deeply altered Isis's relationship with the water. In her homeland, Isis was historically revered as a goddess of the Nile, intimately tied to its annual life-giving floods. Her ability to nourish the land with fertile silt is explicitly celebrated in the inscriptions from the Temple of Philae. She is the one who pours out inundation, which makes all people live and green plants. When the seafaring cultures of the Mediterranean adopted Isis as a universal protector of both the great and the humble, it felt entirely natural to call upon her for safety during naval voyages. In this new maritime role, the Greeks invoked her as Isis Pelagia, or Isis of the sea, the divine guardian of sailors. As Isis expanded her reach, she systematically absorbed the attributes of her divine peers, most notably the goddess Hathor, the ancient patron of music, dance, and joy. Instruments played a central role in Hathor's worship, specifically the sistrum rattle. The instrument was so structurally intertwined with the goddess that countless historical examples exist of sistra intricately decorated with her distinct bovine features. While the sistrum had been a core ritual component used by Egyptian priests since the Old Kingdom to appease and pacify the anger of the gods, it underwent a massive popular revival during the Roman period. Under the banner of Isis, the sistrum moved out of exclusive temple enclaves and into the public festive processions of her widespread Roman cult, as vividly recorded by Apuleius. It reads the following: "Then the crowds of those initiated into the divine mysteries came pouring in, men and women of every rank and age, all together made a shrill ringing sound with their sistrums of bronze and silver and even gold." By the late period, Isis had syncretized not only with Egyptian goddesses like Hathor, Nut, and Maat, but had crossed cultural pantheons entirely to become indistinguishable from classical figures such as Demeter Ceres, Fortuna, Persephone, Hecate, Aphrodite, and Minerva. The transition of Isis from a localized elite protectress of the pharaoh into a universal goddess of the masses, including the poor, enslaved, and marginalized, is one of the most fascinating evolutions in ancient history. This transformation occurred in distinct historical waves, and we know about her lower class following through a mix of archaeological discoveries, temple inscriptions, and the biased but revealing complaints of Roman writers. The final shift into a true religion of the masses happened after Alexander the Great conquered Egypt. Under Greek and later Roman rule, the cult of Isis transformed into an international mystery religion. Unlike traditional Roman state religion, which required patrician bloodlines to hold high priestesshoods, the cult of Isis offered open membership. Anyone, regardless of wealth, citizenship, gender, or legal status, could be initiated. We know that Isis was fiercely loved by the poor, the enslaved, and prostitutes through two primary types of evidence: archaeological, epigraphical data, and classical literature. When Mount Vesuvius erupted in 79 CE, it perfectly preserved the temple of Isis in Pompeii. The physical evidence left behind provides a clear demographic snapshot of her followers. First were freedmen and slaves. Inscriptions on the temple walls show that the rebuilding of the temple after a severe earthquake was funded not by wealthy Roman patricians, but by freedmen or former slaves trying to secure social standing for their children. Also, the voluntary lower class pooling, unlike Roman state temples funded by public tax money. Icyx shrines across the empire were largely built by poor citizens and slaves pooling their meager resources together to fund small altars and devotional paintings. Ironically, our best evidence for prostitutes and marginalized women flocking to Isis comes from elite Roman men complaining about it. Roman poets and satirists, including Ovid, Juvenal, and Propertius, frequently wrote bitter commentary about the types of people who gathered at Isis's temples. Roman elites routinely used xenophobic and patriarchal slurs to smear foreign cults. They complained that the Temple of Isis was an unregulated hotbed for the lower classes, loose women, and the prostitutes. However, looking past their upper-class bias, these texts reveal profound truths about how serious these marginalized women were about their faith. If we look at the Castamonium Isidis, or the chastity of Isis, Roman poets frequently complained that their mistresses and their local prostitutes would completely refuse to have sex with them for 10 days at a time. This was because these women were strictly observing the Castamonium, a rigorous 10-day period of ritual purification, fasting, and sexual abstinence required to participate in Isis's mysteries. This proves that these women weren't just using the temples as social hangouts. They were deeply devout practitioners of a complex theological rite. Roman temples to traditional gods were strictly policed spaces of civic power. The temples of Isis, by contrast, provided a rare public space where marginalized women and prostitutes could gather safely, where they could exercise agency, and find a sense of absolute spiritual equality that Roman society fiercely denied them. To understand why she was so popular amongst the lower classes, you only have to look at her contemporary religious competitors. If we start with the traditional Roman gods, who was banned? Slaves and non-citizens had zero civic or religious power, and the social structure was rigidly aristocratic and it was controlled by the elite Senate. If we also look at the coexisting cult of Mithras, who was banned with that? Well, the cult of Mithras completely banned all women, regardless of class, and it was strictly popular amongst Roman soldiers and imperial bureaucrats. The cult of Isis, however, who was banned no one. It welcomed women, men, the elite, poor, free, and the enslaved. The social structure was egalitarian. Spiritual equality was offered to all of the initiates. Isis didn't judge a person's social or their moral pollution by Roman legal standards. She had suffered. She had been a widow. She had been a single mother in hiding and fought the cosmos to piece her family back together. For a prostitute or a slave in the Roman Empire, Isis was a goddess who understood trauma, offered immediate compassion in life, and promised an equal, beautiful immortality in death. By the 2nd century CE, the worship of Isis had spread throughout the entire Roman Empire, and she was being worshipped by people in every level of society, from emperors to slaves. Isis became the universal goddess. She was the one. A Roman graffito records what I suspect was a mantra of sorts for the ancient Isiacs, and it reads, "Being one, thou art all, goddess Isis." Isis's epithets continued to grow throughout this period. She was known as Isis the Great in the place of her heart. Isis, her years are eternity and everlastingness. Isis, the perfect musician. Isis, she who makes shadow with her feathers. Isis, the Jed pillar. She even personifies her own symbol and is called Isis the Excellent Isis Knot. She's also known as She of Vegetation and Mistress of Herbage who makes the two lands green. If we refer to the Greek magical papyri, also known as the PGM, we may be able to discern some of Isis's secret names. Based on the names of evocation for Isis in the PGM, some of the following are potential secret magical names: Lululu, Ueri, Niseoth, Kamari, Kumati, Ekomo, Teresipot. The shift from the Pharaonic era into the Greco-Roman period brought a profound psychological change in how humans communicated with the divine. In traditional Egyptian thought, prayers were heavily shaped by a highly structured hierarchical society. Worshippers frequently viewed themselves as loyal servants, addressing a helpful, friendly master. But in contrast, Greco-Roman prayers to Isis took on a much more intense, emotionally exposed quality. Petitioners frequently stressed their own wretched humility in the face of her overwhelming, absolute omnipotence, pleading the following, "Hear my prayers, O one whose name has great power." These prayers typically manifested in two distinct formats. First is the paean of praise, which is a pure ecstatic outpouring of her names, her glories, and her cosmic attributes. The second is a sacred transaction. It's a formal vow. If you grant my request, whether it be healing, love, business, I vow to repay you with an offering. Above all else, the Greco-Roman texts emphasize her radical immediate accessibility to the individual soul. She wasn't some distant cosmic force. She was a present goddess. Papyri and artifacts from this era consistently paint a portrait of an omnipresent goddess. One text described her as the divinity to whom one prays in all places. Another assures the devotee that she is not far from you at any hour. A poignant prayer fragment recovered from the Ostracon archive of Hor beautifully encapsulates her dual dominion over life and death, and it reads, "Come to me, Isis. Your praise is among men. Your glory is among the gods, for you give the food to man in his lifetime, and when he dies, it is you who buries." Because of this profound craving for her mere presence, many prayers bypassed complex material requests entirely. Across the sacred landscape of Thebes, the stone walls are covered in ancient graffiti simply repeating the heartfelt urgent phrase, "Come to me, Isis," followed by a stream of her sacred epithets. When specific requests were made, they were tightly bound to physical offerings. This enduring bond between personal prayer, gratitude, and material dedication is perfectly captured in a votive inscription left by a Roman military family at Philae, and it reads to Isis, very great goddess, Cassilis, wife of Herculanus, centurion of the cohort Flavia Silium, with her children has dedicated this offering for a blessing. All the way from the Old Kingdom through the Greco-Roman period, Isis was the great lady of magic. She was the mother of the gods, queen of heaven. She is the Eye of Ra. Isis is great of heart, the divine mourner, lady of the words of power, lady of the life, life-giving, star of the sea, the myriad name one, goddess of women, the one who was all, lady of green crops. And those are just a few of her epithets. Everyone, this is part two of the Goddess Isis episode. We have at least another episode to go. Thank you so much for listening, and I will connect with you soon.